Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The great abortion battles of the 1980s and 90s have left Americans in an unexpected ethical and political netherworld. The great poles of the fight standing tall but lonely. Presidential candidates who are both pro-choice and pro-life. Much has been fought for by both sides. Little has been won outright, but our guest tonight, William Salatin, says the debate is resolving into a kind of pro-choice conservatism and illuminating an unexpected politics. Tonight on Point, the surprising evolution of America's abortion war. We begin with hints of an important shift in Washington on the United Nations and Iraq. In a briefing with regional reporters yesterday, Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage said the Bush administration would consider allowing a UN-sponsored multinational force to operate in Iraq under U.S. command. The transcript was released today. I asked New York Times reporter Douglas Gell about the administration's new signal.
It's unclear exactly what it is, but for the first time, Mr. Armitage is saying publicly that the U.S. is willing to consider the idea of putting a U.N. flag on military operations in Iraq. That's something the United States has not been willing to do until now.
And what is the significance of that remark, a trial balloon or whatever it may be, at this moment?
Well, this is a time when the United States very much needs the help of other countries. Contribute troops to the mission in Iraq, to contribute money to support the ballooning costs, and other countries are so far not willing to go along. They've said if they're asked to contribute, they ought to have a greater voice. If you put the operation under a UN flag in one way or another, the argument goes, perhaps these countries might be willing to ante up with troops and with money.
How big a move or potential move is this from what the administration has been saying up until these remarks?
It's really difficult to know, and the administration's being very cagey about how far it might go or where these discussions are heading. But it could be very significant. This is an arrangement that Kofi Annan, the Secretary General, described last week. And in at least expressing a willingness to consider it, we may be seeing the early outlines of an arrangement that could be finalized sometime next month.
But we heard Donald Rumsfeld just Monday of this week saying that he could not see American troops fighting under a UN command. He said, I think that's not going to happen.
Well, the wording here is very important. Rumsfeld said, I think that's not going to happen, and it's not going to happen if it means U.S. troops under UN command. What could happen is U.S. troops fighting in a mission that is called a UN multilateral force, but that's headed by an American commander who retains command and control over all of the operations. This is something that happened in Somalia in the early 1990s, and I think that's a model that's being considered here.
Do you have a sense, Doug, of how this fits into the debate and tensions within the Security Council? Would a UN flag with a UN commander be enough to bring around France, Germany, India, and others to send troops where they have not been willing to send troops under a straight U.S. leadership?
It's difficult to know, but I think it would have to go further than that. I think a symbolic move would go partway toward satisfying those countries' demands. But what they've really said is that they need a greater voice over what happens in Iraq, a voice perhaps over some military matters, but also over how money is spent, over how decisions are made, over how political authority is transferred to the Iraqis. So I think this would perhaps be part of the answer, but certainly not all of it.
And what's the significance of this coming from Richard Armitage, Deputy Secretary of State? We know there are all kinds of factions in Washington around exactly how to proceed here, but it comes from Armitage.
It does come from Armitage, and one would expect that the State Department would be more in favor of this approach than the Pentagon. The Pentagon hasn't said anything about Mr. Armitage's comments today, although officials at the State Department and at the Pentagon are saying privately that his comments had the blessing of the White House and the Pentagon as well. But there's much to be worked out within the administration as well as within the Security Council, I believe.
And how do you read that conflict or differing views within the administration itself? What are the great camps there now?
Well, the divide in this administration and indeed in many previous administrations, the great divide has been between the Pentagon and the State Department. In this administration, the Pentagon is much more unilateralist, much more aggressive, much more committed to the view that the United States can go it alone in the world. The State Department has been and continues to be a force that says we need to work with other countries. And so in that sense, the fact that this proposal is being floated by the State Department is not a surprise.
If it got a go-ahead from the White House, does that mean there may now be a view that the Pentagon's unilateralist approach is not sustainable?
I think, again, we have to be careful about going too far here. What got a go-ahead from the White House is talking about this idea, mm-hmm. just discussing it rather than rejecting it out of hand.
Mm-hmm.
What might finally be proposed, what might finally be approved, is something that's difficult to tell. But indeed, the fact that it's not being rejected, the fact that it's on the table, suggests clearly a White House that's still looking for new answers to its policy in Iraq, which so far is running into troubles on many fronts.
And what's your sense of the tempo of the consideration of this issue, Doug? The war is very expensive. U.S. troops are dying. There are a lot of pressures here. Might we see this ratcheting up the conversation between Washington and the U.N. over the next matter of days, or is this a months-long consideration?
I think weeks is probably the way to describe it. It's late August in New York, as it is everywhere. Decisions at the United Nations will really get going early next month when the General Assembly has its opening session. Then you'll have foreign ministers from around the world gathering in New York, and I imagine that that would be the forum at which this is discussed. There's going to be a fast tempo for some other decisions, but I think those will be made in Washington rather than in New York.
But for the first time now, the prospect, the possibility of a U.N. flag over the Iraq operations raised by a senior administration official. Douglas Jell, thank you very much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Douglas Jell covers national security for the New York Times. He joined us from Washington. Thirty years after Roe v. Wade, the pro-choice movement today is conceding to an increasingly conservative middle ground. In his new book, Bearing Right, Slate chief political correspondent William Salatin writes that it is liberals who have lost the battle over abortion rights, effectively whittling away a woman's right to an abortion with concessions made for restricted access and mandated parental consent. The abortion debate has been largely resolved, says Salatin, and pro-choice conservatives look like the victors. Have your own views on abortion changed over the years? Do you see a new middle ground? Who's won here and who's lost? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is William Salatin, chief political correspondent for Slate and author of the new book, Bearing Right, How Conservatives Won the Abortion War. Good evening and welcome, William Salatin.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. Thanks for being with us. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Will.
William Salatin, take us in here. We, like much of the nation, perhaps fixated on Roe v. Wade and what happens with the Supreme Court and will it stay or will it fall. You're saying don't just stare at that. The battle's been going on at all kinds of levels. And the subtitle of your book is The Conservatives Won the Abortion War. Take us in. What do you mean?
Well, when I say conservatives, I don't mean pro-lifers. I would distinguish between conservatives and those who believe in a right to life. After all, if you really believe in doing everything possible to promote life, there are lots of liberal things you would have to do in the way of public funding and so forth and adoption and that kind of thing. By conservative, I mean what I call pro-choice conservatives, and they are people who agree with the message that has been delivered by abortion rights groups that the government should stay out of the issue and leave it to the family. But the interpretation that pro-choice conservatives put on that message is very different from the one that the liberal feminist pro-choice activists put on it. The pro-choice conservatives believe that the government staying out means the government shouldn't pay for abortions. In fact, the government shouldn't provide any public facilities for them. And pro-choice conservatives also believe that leaving the issue to the family means leaving it to mom and dad. And in fact, although the courts don't allow it, you will find majority support for leaving it that the husband or in some cases the boyfriend should have an effective veto over the abortion decision. And that is a very different notion of what freedom means from the notion that liberals have. And the way it manifests itself around the country is in parental consent laws, parental notification laws, and bans on public funding of abortion and the use of public facilities for abortion.
So is it your view then that if there's a parental consent required, and if public funding is banned, that the pro-choice crowd or the pro-choice activists have lost?
Well, they've won something and they've lost something. And I think my point is that what they've won is the easy part. That is, they haven't moved the country in the direction of a liberal feminist or women's rights vision, which is the one that they actually hold. What they've done is they've sort of bought off the middle of the country with this message that I consider fundamentally conservative and that they would fairly well acknowledge is pro-family, anti-government. That sounds good to a lot of people, but the problem comes when you run into these restrictions where the people who consider that to mean one thing divide from the activists and basically leave them having lost all of those fights.
So how did that happen in your view?
Well, it didn't happen. It certainly wasn't intended. It was a situation where shortly after Roe v. Wade, abortion rights was under attack all over the country, and the pro-choice groups were outnumbered. They did not have a majority on their side, and they desperately needed to find a message that would reach out to a broader constituency so that they could start winning elections because they were viewed as the weaker party. And in politics, as you know, if you're viewed as the party that can deliver fewer votes, well, the politicians won't go with you. So they developed this broader message. And by golly, it worked for the things that they wanted it to work on. It stopped the erosion of Roe. It stopped Roe v. Wade from being overturned, basically. And if you look at the Supreme Court's decision in 1992, it says we're not going to overturn Roe v. Wade. And it talks about a national consensus. It's a very broad hint that the Supreme Court has seen that the public will not accept the repeal of abortion rights. So the message worked to that extent. The problem is that pro-choicers were not looking down the road to these other issues where they started to run into this buzzsaw of pro-life groups making the same argument pro-family, anti-government, against in favor of parental consent laws and against public funding.
Jack Beattie, join us here. William Salton is saying, hey, conservatives, not necessarily the pro-life crowd, but conservatives have won this war. Does this look like a victory on that front to you? How do you parse it?
Well, it's a very complicated analysis, and he brings to it new terminology, pro-choice conservative, which he justifies and argues out. And as I try to make sense of it, it sort of makes sense to me in terms of the American swing vote in general, that both parties have a kind of veto on them from people who are less interested in the substantial doctrines of those parties, who are not interested in them at all. Our swing vote determines elections, and in abortion, as in other matters, swing voters have a sort of basic, sort of libertarian, conservative outlook that enters into the abortion debate. But I want to come at this slightly askew.
Yeah.
One of the arguments for years has been, you know, who needs Roe? If it goes down, so what? I mean, you know, and there's been a kind of implicit anti-feminism in it. Oh, those women are getting hysterical about this. It'll go back to the states. And what you'll have is electoral politics will lead to consensus as opposed to what we have now, judicial activism leading to division. And Will's book is a sobering reminder that let the states decide is a frightening proposition because it puts this question right in the laps of some troglodytes. That's a technical term for some of the people who act whom he quotes here from these state legislators. In Idaho, for example, the governor had to veto a bill that would essentially allow a rape survivor to end her pregnancy a week after the assault, but then she would cease to be the victim and become a criminal. In Louisiana, one man rallied who supported rallied his colleagues against a spousal rape bill. He pleaded that pregnancies caused by incest shouldn't be exempted from the abortion ban. And here's what he said. When I got to thinking, the way we get thoroughbred horses and thoroughbred dogs is through inbreeding. Maybe we would get a super sharp kid.
Ouch.
These are the Solons who would be deciding the abortion question. It wouldn't be a matter of public fundamental right. It would be a matter of, well, let's see, thoroughbred horses. You know, when we say, and I'm not anti-government, but when I read these kinds of things, I say, well, I don't want those people deciding so fundamental a right.
William Salton, we've just got a few seconds before the break, but doesn't an awful lot still hang on Roe v. Wade, as Jack suggests here, despite the shifts that you're describing?
Well, a lot hangs on Roe v. Wade in the sense that millions of women who get abortions wouldn't be able to or would have to go underground. And I think, however, that underlying Roe v. Wade is Roe v. Wade will collapse if there is not political support for it. The political support for abortion rights is what keeps presidents from appointing justices to the Supreme Court who will overturn Roe. And it actually intimidates the justices as well.
Well, George Bush may be right in that hot seat. We'll talk about what he might do. We're looking tonight at the evolution of the abortion war and the emergence of a new middle ground. You might call it the pro-choice conservatism camp. Have your views on abortion changed over the years? Do you see a new middle ground? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The evolution of the abortion war and the emergence of a new middle ground, you might call it the pro-choice conservatism camp on abortion. Our guest is William Salatin. He's chief political correspondent for Slate and has written a new book, Bearing Right, How Conservatives Won the Abortion War. You can join the conversation. Have abortion rights activists compromised too much on the full unfettered right to abortion? Has that weakened public support for basic abortion rights or strengthened it? Or have anti-abortion rights activists or the conservative allies of those activists compromised too much and effectively accepted abortion? How do you see it? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. William Salatin, you describe how politicians have tried to thread this needle over the years and have been riding the wave of public sentiment, even right up into George W. Bush. Are you saying, describe to us how you see him in particular as having dealt with the abortion issue, and what does it tell you about what might happen if and when he has to name a new or nominate a new justice to the Supreme Court?
Well, the maneuver that I describe George W. Bush as having made his career out of on abortion is what I call the Texas three-step. It consists of a nod, a wink, and a pivot. The nod is a nod to the pro-lifers. It says the Republican Party should be the pro-life party. I believe in a culture of life. It's a nice theme statement. Doesn't imply anything in terms of law. Makes a lot of pro-lifers happy. Then Bush says to pro-choicers, oh, don't worry, I won't overturn Roe v. Wade. There will never be a constitutional amendment outlawing abortion or overturning Roe v. Wade. So that's the wink to say, well, I'm just saying this to the pro-lifers, but I don't really mean it. Don't worry. And then he pivots. And the pivot is to these laws that I call the pro-choice conservative laws. He starts talking about parental consent, the issue that he stressed most avidly when he was governor of Texas, and public funding and, to some extent, partial birth abortion. So that's the strategy that Bush has perfected, and it's very effective.
Now, you point out that in 1999, he signed a law in Texas prohibiting a teenager from body piercing without parental approval. Was that a deliberate pathway being set up there to parental approval on abortion?
Well, I think it's for him, it's part of a constellation of issues. Bush's track record down the line has been parental rights about everything. And it's a way of sort of satisfying the Christian right without antagonizing middle America. And to get back to your first question about Roe v. Wade, if George W. Bush were to appoint justices who overturned Roe v. Wade while he was president, well, for that matter, after he was president, the Republican Party would face another wipeout of the kind that they got in 1990, which was the last time that middle America thought Republicans were seriously on the verge of overturning Roe v. Wade.
So who's posturing here then? I mean, we read in the New Republic recently, they were recounting in January, the abortion rights group NARAL, the pro-choice America, held a dinner in Washington to commemorate the 30th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. And the speakers are all saying, you know, the Supreme Court is one vote away from dismantling the right to choose, raising flags all over the place. Others will be cheering, of course, but you're saying, no, it's not really going to happen. Are you so confident of that?
Well, I would want to divide the issue up more cleanly than pro-choice versus pro-life or legal versus not legal. When those politicians say that Roe v. Wade is one vote away from being overturned, the only thing they can mean, because the only decision that was 5-4 in favor of Roe was the partial birth abortion decision. In other words, Bush could appoint one more justice and that justice might uphold the partial birth abortion ban. Now, that's as far as that would go. Bush would then have to get another justice on the pro-life side in order to overturn Roe outright.
The fundamental
right. And
that's
assuming... Right, that's right. So there's a distinction between those two things. And meanwhile, of course, these justices whom we think of as pro-choice justices or pro-Roe justices are all the time upholding these conservative pro-choice restrictions. They have no problem with these parental consent laws, with public funding bans, and all sorts of other restrictions.
Andrew's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm interested to know if your guest has any anything to say about the etymology of the phrases pro-choice, pro-life. it seems to me that the conservatives have been very effective in the last maybe decade in really grasping the power of the word and delivering a clearer message, so much clearer than the liberals, and if we can use those terms. And I'm just wondering, it seems to me that pro-life was just more powerful in terms of a mobilizing bumper sticker than pro-choice.
William,
I wonder if he has any thoughts on that.
Yeah, we'll take that and run with it, Andrew. Thanks for your call. William Salatin, how about it? You give an awful lot of weight to the importance of choice as well as a political decision. How do you see the semantic game here?
Well, I think pro-life does have a lot of semantic appeal, and you may have noticed that there are a lot of states where they're trying to, the conservative legislators are trying to establish these choose life bumper stickers. Life is a very popular phrase. Of course, once you put the word choose in there, that puts the balance of power back on the pro-choice side, because pro-choicers have no problem with women choosing to have children to bring the child to term. So as long as there's choice, life sort of gets trumped. And I would argue actually that if you look back over the history of the abortion wars, the shift towards the phrase pro-choice on the side that used to be considered, you know, repeal of abortion laws or pro-abortion has had a much greater effect in helping that side than the phrase pro-life has had in changing any dynamics on their side.
And yet you say that it also entailed a kind of compromise. It shifted them toward the center. It made it not a straight-out defense of the right to abortion, but of the notion of freedom from government interference in this decision.
That's right. It definitely had that effect on the pro-choice side. One other thing I would say on the pro-life side, there is actually an empirical way of determining whether it's accurate for someone to call themselves pro-life, and that is you proceed on to these other wedge issues where people who are genuinely pro-life and people who are just anti-abortion split apart. One of those, for example, there was just in New Jersey a decision in the New Jersey Supreme Court upholding a family cap in that state. Now, family caps, which are all over the country, are laws that say if you're a woman and you're on welfare and you have another child, the government will not add to your welfare benefits to support that child. In other words, the message is, if you get pregnant, abort the kid. Now, pro-lifers are against these family caps. Conservatives, including some people who claim to be anti-abortion, are in favor of them. So it's always good to bring up those kinds of issues when someone tells you they're pro-life.
William Salatin, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Kellyanne Conway. She's joining us from Washington, D.C. She's a Republican pollster, CEO and president of The Polling Company. Good evening and welcome, Kellyanne Conway.
It's very nice to be with both of you.
It's great to have you. Kellyanne, you must track this, attitudes toward abortion, abortion rights. What do you make of William Salatin's thesis here that conservatives have won the abortion war, that what he describes as pro-choice conservatives now kind of own the middle, and that's where abortion sits?
Well, Mr. Salatin deserves tremendous praise for doing what so many sort of pro-choice people will not do, which is admit that the culture has changed. And a change in our culture will always lead to a change in public opinion on any major public policy or political issue. What's changed in our culture is everything from the fact that we cherish children now where we did not. If you go back and look at the culture of the 60s and 70s, it was Rosemary's Baby, The Exorcist, in The Omen, even the devil himself was a little boy named Damien. And then all of a sudden 1980 hits and we see baby on board stickers, and now we've got Babies R Us and people throw baby showers the minute they're pregnant. And so even our entire culture has become one that cherishes life and children more than it does individual freedom and choice and the right to do what one wants, as if they live on an island or in a vacuum. So that change in the culture, along with a very important change in the culture, which is seeing is believing. The proliferation of sonograms and ultrasound technology and the ability and access of an average American to have seen a sonogram picture of a developing fetus really is how this debate has shifted, where many Americans are saying to themselves, huh, when this was about seen versus unseen, when this is about the unseen exercise of one's free choice versus protecting a life that I can't see, it was one thing. But now it's actually about I see what's on the sonogram pictures. People have seen sonograms in very non-threatening ways. They've had their mothers mail them a picture and say, oh, look what your brother and sister-in-law are going to have in 3 months, or they've seen it on a colleague's desk for 4 months before that woman gives birth. nobody has held up a sonogram in front of people and said, admit it, it's a baby, isn't it? Or nobody's held it up and said, it's just a polywog, is it not?
But Kelly, let me ask you, what do you make then, and what do your poll numbers show around this central idea that what's emerged is a kind of middle ground that tilts right, that William Shelton describes as pro-choice conservatives?
Well, I would agree with the premise that it's middle ground and tilt right, but I would disagree that the proper phraseology is to characterize as people's pro-choice for a very simple reason. I think that's a bit desperate on the part of the abortion rights lobby because they are trying to get away from the word abortion now that it is truly been accepted as an ugly word. NARAL has dropped it.
Yeah, but the fundamental question here is, do you agree? Do your polling figures show that there's a substantial number who say, hey, I'm conservative, I may want some constraints on it, but at the same time, I want to see this right of a woman to abortion protected, this choice protected?
Well, there are very few Americans, there's a handful of Americans, less than a fifth of Americans that believe that abortion should be prohibited under all circumstances, that it should be outlawed outright. So that is correct. The reason that we no longer ask our question is, are you pro-life or pro-choice, is precisely because of these restrictions and considerations that people are lending and demanding now, not to have an unfettered right to abortion, but some of these restrictions. To wit, you see overwhelming majorities of Americans in our polls and other polls say that they believe in parental consent laws, that they believe in spousal notification, perhaps not spousal consent, but spousal notification where the woman actually has a husband and the husband is presumed to be the father of the child. You see that this Child Custody Protection Act has great bipartisan support in the Congress. That means that a child cannot be taken over state lines without the consent of her parents into a state which provides abortion. For example, a lot of these sexual predators who were impregnating 14, 15, 16-year-old girls were taking those girls over, who can't drive themselves, taking them over the boundaries into a state where they could obtain an abortion. And so Congress is trying to protect against that. I think that's an example of one of the restrictions that people are demanding be an honest and reasonable common sense check on an unfettered right to abortion.
But do you agree with the notion that a Republican president will not set up the overturn of Roe v. Wade in the Supreme Court because it would lead to large Republican losses, that it just won't happen because the poll numbers don't reflect that people would accept it?
No, it's a cynical political calculation in the following sense. The poll numbers also suggested that George W. Bush's first tax cut would be unpopular, and he passed that in June of 2001, long before 9/11, and when his approval ratings were only at 52%. The polls prove that people think that some form of stem cell research is a good idea, although this president is very opposed to that. So he's not, you look at George W. Bush, you can't really count on him as someone who heeds the polls the moment that they come off hot off the presses. That said, we all lived through the Reagan-Bush years, 12 years of Reagan-Bush, and the appointment of avowedly or supposedly, someone like me would say, pro-life justices, and Roe has been strengthened, not weakened. Roe was strengthened in the Thornburg decision. Roe was strengthened all through the 1990s, and it was strengthened not only because it was not overturned, but also because it was implicated in some of those decisions, either through the opinions or through dicta within those decisions, which means, you know, language that doesn't need to be in the decision. A former lawyer, I guess I could say that. And that these justices who were supposed to be pro-life and supposed to be just salivating to overturn Roe did not do so in 12 years of the Reagan-Bush administration. So I think this is a good way for the pro-abortion rights lobby to raise money, to get people all nervous and exercised that people are going to take away a woman's right to choose, because if they don't have that, the abortion rights lobby is going to disappear.
But William Southup, let me put it to you there. Kellyanne Conway acknowledges the record of the Reagan-Bush era, but she says it's a cynical view to imagine that George Bush wouldn't step up and support justices who might overturn Roe v. Wade anyway.
Based on political calculations, that was what you said.
William Shelton.
Well, there were comments, I mean, there were several from John Ashcroft in the first week of the, I can't remember whether it was the administration or during the confirmation process. It was in January of 2001. There were comments from George W. Bush during the campaign that were more veiled, but John Ashcroft said, we will not seek opportunities to overturn Roe v. Wade. He said that several times, and it was a very clear message. don't worry, we're going to focus on tax cuts and the other issues that unite the Republican coalition. And Republicans really don't want to risk blowing up their coalition by taking on abortion. Let me just point out one thing. When Kellyanne was listing some of the pro-life restrictions that show up well in the polls, the three that I wrote down that she talked about, parental consent laws, spousal notification, Child Custody Protection Act, which, as she pointed out, is a parental consent sort of interstate law. Mm-hmm. All three of those, to my mind, are what I call pro-choice conservative law. They are about family rights. They are not, per se, about protecting the right to life.
And they're all constraints on abortion rights, as you see.
Right. An abortion ban says the government's going to come in. We don't care what your family thinks. We're going to protect this unborn life. A parental consent law says mom and dad get to decide this is a matter of leaving it in the family. And if you look at polls, that's what most pro-choice voters, who are generally conservative pro-choice voters, believe. So I would argue that what those polls show is confirms that conservative pro-choice is the center and not particularly a pro-life view.
Jack, join us here. I wonder how volatile you see this this kind of right-leaning middle ground that William Shelton describes, his pro-choice conservatives ground. Does that look stable to you? Do you have the same confidence he does that a Republican president, perhaps this Republican president, would not have the nerve to set up an overturn of Roe v. Wade outright?
Well, I think that the abortion question really for both parties is a little bit like tort reform. You know, it's the hardy perennial. The Republicans say we're going to ban abortion, and out come the contributions from the right to life people. And on the other side, the Republicans are going to ban abortion, out come the contributions from the pro-choice people. So there's an element here of what should one call it, coalition bonding that goes on in these issues. It makes it hard to see what's really at stake. Before I read this book, I would have said that things like parental consultation and the
consent.
Ban on federal funding or state funding for abortion, I would have said that those trims, that those abridgments of the pure right of abortion legitimated the core right, that they were ways in which the consensus, the uneasy conscience of the country was satisfied to preserve the core right if you meet me halfway on these other things. And perhaps partial birth abortion, although I don't like that term, perhaps that's another one too.
And now having read it?
Well, now having read how all this came about, I'm not so sure. I mean, I see it as a much more conservative thing, but I still do think that is true substantially. That is, that these abridgments have strengthened, have as it were drawn some of the teeth from the pro-life movement and have created a kind of consensus that keeps the core right there.
Kellyanne Conway, we just got you for a few more seconds. Have we reached a kind of stable consensus here in your mind? Is the status quo where the country is likely to stay for the foreseeable future?
The country is likely, when pollsters ask the country, are you pro-life or pro-choice, you still will have a plurality saying they're pro-choice because it's a very popular concept. When you tease it out into a six-point scale, as we do in our polling, where you ask people which of the following comes closest to your view on abortion, I think this is where you see Mr. Salatin's book come to life. We ask people in rotated fashion, which of the following comes closest to your opinion on abortion? Abortion should be prohibited under all circumstances. Abortion should be allowed, but only to save a life of the mother. Abortion should be allowed, but only to save a life of the mother or in cases of rape or incest. Abortion should be allowed for any reason but not past the first 3 months or first trimester. Abortion should be allowed for any reason but not past the first 6 months or second trimester. And finally, abortion should be allowed for any reason at any time during a woman's pregnancy. Well, when you ask a six-point scale that way, when you invite Americans to give you their gradations of viewpoints on the one issue in our culture which melds together law, religion, morality, politics, gender, you name it.
Give us the bottom line.
They listen, a majority of people go for prohibit under all circumstances or the restrictions of life of the mother, rape, incest, or first trimester.
There it is. And with that, we've got to take a break. This is On Point.
Support for this program comes from OSR Consulting
of the abortion war and the emergence of a new middle ground you might call pro-choice conservatism. My guest tonight, William Salatin, has a new book out, Bearing Right, How Conservatives Won the Abortion War, and he asserts pro-choice conservatism is the new lay of the land. We're also joined tonight by Kellyanne Conway from Washington, D.C. She's CEO and president of the Polling Company. You can join us as well. Has America reached a new consensus on abortion despite all the sound and fury? Have the warring parties fought to a standstill, a peace here? And how important is abortion to you in the 2004 election? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Kellyanne Conway, we slid into that break on such a tight leash that I want to be absolutely sure I understood what you were saying there. When you break abortion down over all those six categories, which are the one or two that have the greatest support in the polls?
The greatest support is the one that has abortion should be legal, but only to save the life of the mother or in cases of rape or incest. That, in our recent poll of just women, by the way, that we did for a client named CareNet, that is 26%, and you add to that the 24% who said abortion should be legal but not past the first trimester or first 3 months. You add those together, and then when you add them together with those who said prohibit under all circumstances or to only save the life of the mother, you're up to like over two-thirds of the American women in this country saying...
Okay, so we've got this. Let me put that to you, William Selton. What do you make of those poll numbers? Do you buy them, and how do they, and do they jive with your theory, your thesis?
Well, in that part of what Kellyanne's saying, I'm skeptical of, because it's a question that, first of all, it's very long, and an average person hearing a survey is going to say they're going to sort of pick something in the middle if you give them six things. The other thing that I have a problem with is the way it combines two different dimensions of the debate. Which circumstances would you allow abortions, more or fewer? Which stages of pregnancy would you allow it? I mean, it's all sort of...
That's what Roe is about, Mr. Salas, and that's what Roe is about. And I got to tell you, it's the only pollster on the call. I've got to defend my industry because that's rotated. You don't pick the things in the middle. You could have heard the beginning at the end. I could have heard the end at the beginning. The host could have heard the middle. All the six categories are rotated randomly.
We've got it. William Selton?
Yeah, well, I just think a person who hears these mentally, even if the pollster juggles them around, the mentally the person sort of lines them up and is inclined to choose something in the middle.
If I'm
getting that question, I'm having a hard time answering it because it may require me to embrace abortion in circumstances I wouldn't like in order to get the stage I prefer, a regulation at the stage of pregnancy I prefer. But I wanted to come back to something that Kellyanne said earlier that I thought was interesting when she was talking about life, because we've been talking about choice this whole time, and I thought she made some interesting points about the culture of life. And what's interesting to me is not just cultural changes that she may be tracking, but legislation that's coming up in Congress and in the states, and the way that the debate is changing technologically. And there are some tactics that conservative forces are using, let's say pro-life forces in Congress are using, that are changing the issues in play, and those
such
are quite
as,
interesting.
Such as?
Well, I think that there are basically three kinds of legislation in abortion in Congress these days. One is these conservative pro-choice things I've been talking about. But there's two other things that pro-lifers are doing. One is they're starting to talk about defending abortion when it coincides with defending the right to life when it coincides with the right to choose, like the Unborn Victims of Violence Act. That's something I think Kellyanne mentioned. And the other thing is there are several issues on which pro-lifers are trying to move the debate about the right to life out of the womb altogether, and that's taking place through the partial birth abortion debate. There was a bill called the Born Alive Infants Protection Act, and now we're into stem cells and cloning, where we're talking about the rights of embryos outside of women, and that shakes up the dynamics a lot.
So technology itself may move it out of the womb. I want to turn to our phones. Anne's calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Anne. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm just trying to gather all of my thoughts from all of this. Wait. I'm 56 years old.
Okay.
I've been a part of this debate for the past, 40 years at least, since my late teens.
Mm-hmm.
And my position hasn't changed. Contrary to one of your recent guests, the woman who's doing the polling, when women are making these decisions, I don't think they go through a scale of six choices as to which one of those choices was most allowable. Now, can I have an abortion because something happened to me? Or B, can I have an abortion because it's to save my life? Or C, that's not the decision process for women in that position. So I think to make that the criteria for how people make these decisions isn't valid.
But Anne, might it not be the position of a voter, female or not?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And isn't that what's going to decide this?
It begs the question as to why the female voter, male voter, politician, politic gets to exercise their voice over what this woman has chosen to do with her body.
And let me ask you, do you buy William Seligman's analysis here that there's a new kind of conservative middle ground where he sees this issue having landed? And it's not an unfettered right. There's parental consent and there's all the other constraints that we've talked about tonight. Do you see that as a kind of stable national consensus that's been achieved? And does it work for you?
No, I don't. I think it is a consensus that's being developed, and I agree with his observation. On the other hand, many of the people who are being solicited for these points of views are women who have been born into a generation that had that security behind them, and who don't realize the. Don't have a sense of the pain, not the history. I don't know how to put this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, unfortunately, I know several women who lost their mothers to the back street abortions, who were good Catholics, who had too many children. You know, I've known women who've been abused inside the family. Do you think the victims of incest are always going to come forward and say, I need an abortion because my father raped me?
And we've got it, and we appreciate your call very much tonight. William Seligman, what about this? Ann calls and says, I'm 56, and this is how I feel about it, and I'm not changing. But is there a generational divide here among Americans, among women? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think so, and I think Kellyanne would say the same thing. And Kellyanne talked about one of the factors, which in her view is a change in the culture of life. I think what Anne's call points up is another factor, and that is, first of all, there's complacency on the pro-choice side because they believe that the courts have locked this up for them. They don't need to mobilize about it. But the other thing is that a lot of people have forgotten what it was like before Roe v. Wade, and they've forgotten what, you know, about back alleys or about the difficulty of getting abortions in that era. And a lot of pro-choice groups, of course, will complain about that as the factor behind the shift in polls that Kellyanne talks about. Now, I think probably both factors are in play.
Kellyanne, 5 years out, do you see Roe v. Wade standing or not?
I see Roe v. Wade standing, but I see Anne as a very typical member of the baby boom generation. As I've observed and written in the past about this issue is five. I'm glad you said 5 years, because 5 years, 10 years from now, there will be more women in this country who feel ardently about the abortion issue, who are past menopause, who are post-menopause and literally unable to conceive and bear a child or terminate that pregnancy, then there will be the same type of passion among women who are in the prime of their childbearing years. Anne chalks it up to the fact that women in my generation perhaps were born with the security. Many women in my generation believe that we were born into the blight, really, the awful legacy of Roe versus Wade. And many of us were latchkey kids. 40% of those born between in the Generation X years between 1965 and 1978, 40% of whom lived in a single-parent household by the age of 16.
And you've got a different view. Kellyanne Conway, we're running out of time here, but I want to thank you for being with us tonight. Thanks so much for joining us. Kellyanne Conway, CEO and president of The Polling Company. And William Seligman, thanks for the thesis. Thanks for your time. You've made us think. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
William Seligman is author of the new book, Bearing Right, How Conservatives Won the Abortion War. Jack Beatty, your final thought here. Is there still an abortion right? And is it firm?
I think it's firm, and I think the culture helps to support it. Culture is a quarrel, a dialectic. And the same time where we have this reverence for life, we also have a Supreme Court decision that speaks of the right of gay people to have sex as, quote, a form of liberty. Well, I believe that a woman's right to her body is also a form of liberty, and there's a whole tendency in our culture that goes in that direction as well.
We will all be watching. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
In a moment, confessions of an airline baggage screener. This is On Point. $3.7 million Americans plan to take to the skies this Labor Day weekend, and with all those passengers comes an avalanche of luggage for the Transportation Security Administration to screen. New York writer Beth Pinsker knows firsthand the difficult task facing airline baggage screeners. She worked for the TSA for 3 months earlier this year. She recently wrote an essay, Confessions of a Baggage Screener.
The suitcase was ticking. It was my third week on the job as one of 55,000 new airport screeners employed by the Transportation Security Administration, and the first day of the war in Iraq. The nationwide terror alert was at orange, and a pair of National Guardsmen patrol the sprawling departure lobby of the U.S. Airways terminal at LaGuardia, rifles at the ready, gas masks strapped to their thighs. All of this made the egg timer click coming from the bag a matter of some urgency. I had picked up the suitcase after it was singled out by one of the cream-colored SUV-sized machines that X-ray checked luggage. I put it on a metal examination table, as I had been trained to do, and swabbed the surface with a cloth-tipped wand. It tested negative in the explosive trace detector. I unzipped the bag gingerly and faced a jumble of women's clothes, mostly polyester and flowered, then stuck in a latex-gloved hand to feel for solid objects. Almost immediately, I discovered an item dense enough to have been flagged as a possible explosive. It was hair cream. But no clock, no bomb, and no explanation for the ticking. Behind the frosted glass partitions near the check-in counter, $5 million worth of bomb detection technology buzzed around me. None of it could help. Once the machine identified a suitcase as suspicious, it was my job to search it by hand. The only way to determine the source of the ticking came down to a $13-an-hour worker. I need to follow my trainer's instructions and go EDU, elbows deep in underwear. So far, I had seen the machines flag plenty of deodorant sticks, toothpaste tubes, and shoe heels, which showed up on the screen outlined in red. I had handled sex toys, machetes, and pistols. But the closest thing I had seen to a bomb were manufactured images on the screen created by the Threat Image Projection System, a software package developed by the government to make sure we were paying attention. The ticking was real enough, though, and I couldn't let the suitcase through until I figured out its origin. I took everything out, stacking clothes on the table. I felt around the lining. I turned the suitcase over once more, noted that the ticking stopped, and saw a bulge in a tiny pocket tucked between the rods for the extendable handle. It was an electric toothbrush that turned on when pressed against the table. Picking through other people's skivvies was my very small part in a very big government initiative. More than 4 million checked bags pass through the nation's 429 commercial airports on any given day. And since the beginning of the year, the Transportation Security Administration has been charged with examining all of them, on the slim chance that one contains a bomb. The first stop for checked bags is what's called a CTX machine, which uses conventional X-ray technology as well as a CT scanner that slices beams through a piece of luggage to determine the density and volume of the contents. The problem is that the CTX flags everything with the same volume and density as some explosives. These include peanut butter, toothpaste, chocolate, golf balls, shoe heels, blow pops, and believe it or not, live crabs. The CTX stops as many as 35% of all bags. A few alarms a day, and screeners will investigate every one thoroughly. A few dozen, and they become inured to the routine. The system would be better if more screeners were like one of the guys on my shift, a former military man. When he opened a bag, he purposefully examined each item. He turned tubes of toothpaste over in his hand. He shook golf balls and unfolded clothes. Most of my colleagues weren't so careful. One screener, a holdover from the private company that ran LaGuardia security before the TSA took over, would sometimes take bags that were supposed to be searched by hand and just leave them on the examination table until another worker, who assumed they had already been cleared, sent them on the plane. One day I was at the controls of the CTX, which ejects bags like a toaster, bouncing them against a hard backstop. Safety regulations required moving the luggage before making even a cursory check. My fellow screener, however, started searching a suitcase where it landed and was hit square in the head by the next bag. That was our interim supervisor. The government would like to find a more sensitive machine that would support the CTX, or a completely new system that would make the screening process more efficient. The goal is to find a machine that identifies every bomb while keeping false positives to a tolerable level. That's a formula sure to please passengers, not to mention my former colleagues on the front lines.
Beth Pinsker is a writer living in New York City. She worked as a baggage screener for the Transportation Security Administration for 3 months earlier this year. Her essay first appeared in Wired magazine. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this program comes from Soffit.